Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with...
John Carroll Lynch. How you doing?
Pretty good. It's an honor to have you in here. Are you kidding me? We've been watching and loving your movies for years.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
But today we are here to talk about your directorial debut, Lucky. Thanks so much for coming in to talk about it.
Thank you.
Now, obviously, we booked this interview. You made the movie having no idea that this would be that the tragic news we would hear.
Yeah,
Harry Dean Stanton died last Friday. But man, knowing now that he's gone, it's just he's frozen in time on screen, and you'll get goosebumps. So what's your reaction to how it's recontextualized?
I haven't seen the movie since he died, so it'll be interesting to see it. It certainly changes the context of the film. It doesn't change the meaning of the film or the warmth or the humor or anything else about it. It's really a movie about living. Harry Dean is such a captivating actor and such a great human figure. You know, he was always complicated, and his characters are always complicated. And this one's a beautiful performance, and one that fittingly ends his career.
Yeah, we'll go way more into his Lucky role in a second. But while I'm thinking of Harry Dean Stanton, do you have a favorite role over the years? Is it Repo Man?
Cool Hand Luke? It's been interesting to see all of the outpourings of love for him and his work over the course of his 60-year career. So, for me, as an actor, the Straight Story, which is a 5-minute piece that he does, to see an actor. Reenact an entire film, watching. You know, he comes out of his house, and his brother's there. He's had a vendetta with his brother for years, and he sees his brother for the first time. He's been ill. Harry Dean's character had, and he looks over and sees this lawnmower that his brother has ridden all the way to his house, and you watch Harry Dean. Just reenact the whole trip that you've just watched for an hour and a half.
Right.
And he does it all without saying a word.
Yeah.
And it's all in his eyes. It's a clinic of film acting.
Absolutely. Before we dive, I guess, too far into character theme and all that, give our listeners the basic premise,
deal. The movie is the spiritual journey of a 90-year-old atheist. He's a cantankerous, self-reliant man who lives on the edge of this Arizona town and in between the town and the desert. And he's lived there for years, has his routines, goes to his diner, knows everybody, but thinks of himself kind of like the sheriff of this little town, de facto mayor. And he goes to his diner, he watches his game shows, does his crossword puzzles, goes to his bar, and that's his life. And then one morning he's making his coffee and he falls down in his kitchen. And from there, he goes to his doctor, and then he starts wondering about how much time he has left that he may not have, years and decades left. He may just have months and weeks. Yeah. And it really messes with him,
Yeah.
But he comes to a realization of how to live in the shadow of death, and it's something that's worth the trip, and the supporting cast is so terrific, and the screenplay is so great, and so just a really beautiful movie. I'm very proud of it.
I love the way you put that, living in the shadow of death, but it's about life.
Living.
That's what was great about it.
Yeah, and also it's really actually how I'm living, how everybody is.
Right.
The illusion.
Right, that's the larger point. Yeah, the realism.
To me,
the illusion
is, that we live under is that we are not living under it. Somebody who's 89 years old, of course, is living in the shadow of death, but right. I'm not because I'm not there.
But technically, we all are. We're just a blink of an eye.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like my own mortality is like a muscle that's like a sore muscle. Like you try to rub it out, and it just slips away from you. It's in your periphery, but it's hard to keep in focus, and it's particularly hard, I think, because it's so frightening. But this movie demystifies all of it. You know, he's such a seeker. Is Lucky in the movie, and he really comes to some place about it that is actually doable. You know, it's actually doable, which is what I love about it.
To that point, I mean, you just said that it's something that a lot of people fret and fear over, but. Mm-hmm. There's a line in the movie. I can't remember the exact line, but there's only darkness. And then they say, what do we take away from that? And he's like, you just smile. Smile at that.
One of my favorite lines in the movie is there's this exchange with this lawyer in the movie played by Ron Livingston. And Ron says he's advising David Lynch's character, Howard, about wills and stuff like that.
He
loves his tortoise. And he says, well, we're just planning for the unexpected.
Yeah.
And Lucky says, what's unexpected?
Yeah.
And it takes Bobby, Ron's character, aback. He's like, you can't say death because, of course, death is expected.
Right.
And that's Lucky's point is, what's unexpected about dying? We're all going to do it.
Right, right. Is there something in there in his name, too, that the fact that it's Lucky? Are you also playing with fate versus luck in that
It's definitely metaphorical. Yeah. And he is described as Lucky, both in terms of, he gets his nickname from his time in the Navy in World War II. He fought in World War II, both our lead actor and the character, because so much of the movie is based on his life. It's almost inspired by him. Mm-hmm. So that's how the movie was born. But now when he's 89, he's described as Lucky again by his doctor.
Yeah.
And
right,
he says,
in fact, most people I'd say stop smoking, but you just keep smoking.
Yeah, Lucky's... We are playing on the word lucky. You know, he is. Yeah. He's, anybody who gets to be 89 years old in good health is ridiculously lucky. Mm-hmm. Most of us don't get there. And his vitality as a human being, which we see alongside literally in the same body as his fragility, is so resonant and so beautiful. Also, it's so funny. I mean, it's a funny movie.
Some of the quips he has at people are hilarious.
Yeah, he's got a wit.
Talk about, you mentioned the crosswords a few seconds ago, mm-hmm. but I thought that was actually a really smart, brilliant way to kind of weave in the exposition of the theme. You know, there's a lot of movies that feels heavy-handed, and this is your theme. But you're able through that to get him to like say the definition of realism to like three different people, but it's totally plausible with the A story. You know what I mean?
It's absolutely
so true.
Talk about
how realism is that theme and how you wove that.
Well, realism is what we're playing with in the movie. When you've done as much work as I have as an actor and as a storyteller, the genres, the forms of storytelling, be they farce or comedy or they all have different styles, and realism is one of them. Naturalism, realism, surrealism, mm-hmm. Brechtian, all the kinds of ways in which you dice it up and make it something that an audience can grab a hold of. Realism is what we're playing with, but it's real, but it's not real at the same time. So it's so great in the screenplay that we start with such a bold definition of what we're talking about.
And what's real to you is not my real
real.
That's what he says.
And Harry Dean, as an actor, just insists, he throughout his career, he brought with him to every scene, every moment, such a naturalism, such a sense of real, that he just wouldn't go past. He just, he insisted that it all feel that way.
Yeah. So you related to him on an actor level, but because you've done so many roles. But in terms of you being, let's pivot a little into this is your directorial debut and going into that realm. Do you throw on Paris, Texas, and get a feel for how he's going to look in those sort of desert scapes, or do you, what's sort of the preparation?
Well, I watched Paris, Texas. I watched Last Picture Show. There's a lot of movies that were kind of inspiring on our list,
Like the Ben Johnson kind of old line
exactly,
character.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and also that, the feeling of the fraying of this town, what's left of it.
The decaying. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And also I watched some Jim Jarmusch and some other directors that were kind of in the wheelhouse of this movie.
David Lynch, obviously,
Dead Man, but also Mystery Train, and because there's so much vivid color in Mystery Train. So those things were obviously, part of the preparation. But the preparation was beautifully intense discussions, not only with Harry Dean, but also with the writers and the producers and my collaborators, like the director of photography, Tim Schierstead, and Almitra Corey, the production designer, Lisa Norcia, the costume designer. Those are conversations that as an actor you don't get to have.
Right.
And suddenly I'm having them and I'm just loving everything. Like to have a meeting where you get to choose the phone, you know, like you have six phones. And even at a budget level of ours, you know, where she's scrounging in, you know, old prop shops and right. And in
it's a red landline, is that what
it's it's a kind of a burnt orange 1970s 1970s push button phone. Like I remember them so distinctly when I first saw those phones. You would pick it up and there wouldn't be a dot, there wouldn't be a tone. You'd hear the clicks of the rotary. It would still count out the clicks. but then they became, we use it as a dial tone, as a beeping phone, you know, as a tone phone. But the other thing is, you know, back to Harry Dean's work, you know, he wanted everything to feel real, so much so that there were times we had to talk him out of things like, you know, he really wanted to smoke pot in the movie. Like, he's like, what if we just smoke pot? And it's like, we got a long day ahead of us. We got a lot to do today. I don't know that that's the best choice in terms of a work ethic.
Yeah.
But, and also, you know, he wanted to have real alcohol in his drinks. And we managed that as well. Although there was tequila in his drinks.
Yeah.
It wasn't nearly as much as he thought there was, I think.
Yeah.
But when you have somebody who insists on that level of truth, it brings everybody into that same realm. He establishes the palette of acting for everybody else in the piece. I've had the good fortune of working with actors like that before as an actor, and it's always brings you down to a really, really beautiful place of listening and responding. And he never seems to be acting at all. Never, ever seems to be acting. You can never catch him at it.
Well, I'm glad you let him sing a little in the movie too, because that was one of my when he sings that, what is it, I was thinking Near God to Thee and Cool Hand Luke.
Oh
when Paul Newman visits
such a closer walk with thee.
Yeah, closer walk with thee. Yeah, yeah. And then of course we get Plastic Jesus afterwards, which is the counterbalance.
Exactly.
But you got director's chops, sir, because the scene when he passes out when he's watching the flashing 12.
Yeah.
I love how you get the red flashing on his face. I thought that was really cool. And then later when he wakes up in a dream sequence, but he's kind of going towards like it looks almost like a rave or something.
Yes,
you know,
that's right. It's like
it's like a basement. Are you playing with the red?
Absolutely.
Is there a symbolic like you're?
Well, I mean, I think that in the movie there's a sense that those things that are red represent a kind of mortality, a kind of spiritual checkout.
Yeah,
you know, there's. You know, the clock, the phone, and the red alley are all moments where mortality is present for him in a way that's not extraordinarily comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And that frightened him. Yeah. And the way in which the story works is you're inside his head the whole movie. You know, you're inside his heart, really. Yeah. And so you have to follow it from that point of view. It's not a logical story in the sense of I always worry about too much logic in movies because we don't behave logically, but we do behave intuitive logic, mm-hmm. and there are things that we do that make us feel better that don't make any sense except that they make us feel better. Like he kicks a can in the movie to try to make himself feel better, that kind of thing where it makes sense to us emotionally. It's not logical, but it's emotionally accurate.
Right, exactly. Well, I think part of the reason you were able to get such a great, is it his final role or is there a couple others in the can?
No, as far as I know,
last
this was
one,
it.
I think, The reason I think you were able to get such a great final performance from him is because you, sir, are one of the best going as well today.
Thank you.
On the other side of the camera.
Thank
you. And speaking to that, I just wanted to say, nice watch.
Thank you,
If anyone remembers Zodiac, the Zodiac one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Can I see it?
Yeah. I thought that was great. Fincher was great in that.
Oh, yeah. He did a great job in that foursome. Elias, Kataeus, Anthony Edwards, Mark Ruffalo, and I had one of the best days on set I've ever had.
Well, we just interviewed Jake Gyllenhaal yesterday for his
Stronger
movie.
He looks fantastic in that.
Memories of that final scene when he walks in and you're staring at him. Because your face shifts.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, oh, can I help you? And then it's, oh, ooh. And then it's like so much goes on there without saying anything.
I had worked with Jake first as his father in Bubble Boy, and then I played his tormenting his tormenting small-minded boss in Jack Field, your store manager, in The Good Girl. And this was the third time we worked together in this movie. So when we were doing that scene, Graysmith so desperately needs to know. I mean, it's like, I mean, the scene is written like the end of Moby Dick, where Ahab is tied to the whale, and in the book, Melville writes, and the whale looks at Ahab, and Ahab looks at the whale, and that's kind of how I saw this. Saw the they recognize each other right. in that moment. So that's at least what I went in with. But we were doing that scene, and in a break, Jake said, "You are now the official weirdest conglomeration of characters, I think, that I've played with. You've played my father, you've played my boss, and now you've played my whale. This is, that's a pretty wide swath."
I love that you view that as the whale. That's
great. And Chris, the other person you mentioned was Chris Cooper, who he'd worked with for like four times. So it's great. Nice to come back to work with people again. And Jake's work right now is, he's really doing inspiring work, Nightcrawler, and he's really pushing the envelope, and it's exciting to see.
Absolutely. Before we get back, wrap it around full circle to Lucky, my listeners would hate me if I don't ask you about Fargo, because we love Norm.
Thank you.
Norm is the most lovable character.
Thank you.
And I just love, I mean, talk about how the Coens in their script, but also you and Francis as Marge, as you know, pregnant cop.
Yeah, Marge and Norm.
Yeah, Marge and Norm. You're doing the scent stamps, the duck stamp,
the
mallards.
Yeah, the three scent stamps, yeah. Well, those... That was in the script, obviously. The duck stamps were in the script. And the Coens grew up in St. Louis Park, and across the street from them were these three brothers, the Houtmans. And the Houtmans actually all were wildlife artists. They grew up to be wildlife artists. It's kind of interesting that there were filmmakers on one side and painters on the other in this little suburb of Minneapolis. Anyway, the Houtmans are mentioned in the script. And I asked if I could go meet somebody who did this, and they set up an appointment with the youngest of the three Houtman brothers. And the other two had won the duck stamp contest. He had yet to win the national duck stamp contest. There are duck stamp contests in every state in the union, but they're not postage stamps. They're wildlife refuge stamps.
Okay.
If you want to go bird watching or duck hunting, you have to buy a stamp to get onto the property. It's a yearly thing you have to buy. It's a permit, essentially.
Right, right.
And in the federal government, they have a contest every year that they describe a scene. They give you the size of the canvas and what kind of duck you have to have. Whether it's male or female, whether it's nesting aloft, what season they want, and everybody paints it like a winter blue-winged teal aloft in a winter, in a winter scene, and then everybody paints that scene, and they have celebrity judges who come to D.C. and everybody sends it in, and they have they open the gallery. I think I don't know where it is, but I think it's probably at the Department of Interior, and because that's who makes the stamps. And then they go through and they choose one. And it is absolutely, utterly, and completely just honor.
Oh, wow.
You get no money from it. You give the federal government the license to print the stamp from your print. However, there is a subculture of thousands of people who buy copies of that print, and they buy one every year of the National Duck Stamp Contest winner.
Wow.
So the Houtmans... the two Houtman brothers that had won, he is now, the guy I talked to has now won too. This was years ago, obviously. I'm sure they've won multiple times since
because then. He talked to you. I'm sure that's why.
That's likely. Likely it's because I made this guy who had been chasing it his entire life, I finally clarified what was wrong. each of his other brothers had made $1 million from that contest winning because they get a license, they get a royalty for each print that's sold.
Yeah.
So it's worth $1 million at the time when we did the movie. It was worth $1 million.
Wow.
So
can't you see there's more to life than a little money, though?
Yeah,
yeah, but they're getting it honestly, though.
Yeah, they are. They're just and they sit in duck blinds in blinds all over the country for weeks on end, taking pictures of ducks and then bringing them home and then painting scenes from them. That's awesome. But the other thing was when I came back to the Coens and said, you know, it's not a, just to let you know, I don't want you to change a thing, but It's not a postage stamp. There is no second place. I don't want to change the thing. It's perfect the way it is, but you're going to get letters. There's going to be people who's going to go, look, you're getting this wrong, and it's upsetting to me because they're so passionate about
it. But see, your background knowledge is what layered that texture under that character.
Well, I mean, that's the idea of what you're supposed to do, obviously, with acting, is you're supposed to deepen your understanding of the world that you're living in. And that's part of what drew me to get deeper and deeper into storytelling and try to direct, because you get to be free of the instrument of your own body and be able to. It's like when somebody who's in a band gets to arrange. You know, they finally get to think about, if they're a drummer, how does the sax fit in? You know, so it's that kind of thing that you get to do. And this was a great opportunity because the script was so strong, and obviously Harry Dean and the rest of the cast were so incredible to work with.
Well, I can almost see a little bit of that. The way you kind of hold your camera back and sort of patiently watch, sort of like, I call it like fate watching everybody. Mm-hmm. I can see the mental connection almost for you into, you know, the Prowler needs the jump scene, for instance.
Sure.
The Coens hold the camera in the kitchen. You're in there doing
Without
the gender swap, making the breakfast, and Marge is outside. But that's kind of like what you do in this as well.
Roger Deakins' frames are so strong for them, and they insist. They really, the control of the camera and the control of the storytelling is so strong. But it is true in this particular movie, and this is just a difference in terms of the way the movies are written and stuff. This movie, it was important for, I talked to Tim a lot about, I want to feel like I'm in the room with him. I want to feel like I'm sitting across the couch from him, you know. I want to be in a diner booth with him. Right. I don't want to be sitting coldly watching him from another room or vicariously. Mm-hmm. And also after the fall in the movie, it becomes much more point of view, it becomes much more intimate. And that was kind of the visual vocabulary we began with, you know. Right. And when you get to use the camera like that, it becomes we don't want it to. And every time we did the edit, the simpler we did it, the better the movie became, because the movie really wanted to be to leave the performances whole and not mess with them. And that's great. There are other movies. I mean, as an example, Hudsucker Proxy. That movie doesn't work without that kind of really aggressive, or Raising Arizona, that Barry Sonnenfeld, I think, was the DP on that. And he has such an aggressive visual style for the movie. The movie doesn't work without it. I mean, you've got to have those big, pans in and the swooping camera. You've got to have a sense of almost cartoon because it's such a heightened reality.
It's case by case basis.
What is the story you're telling? Mm-hmm. How do you want to tell it? And how is it going to be most effective? And where do you want the audience to sit in it? So, sometimes you want to be out of the room. Sometimes you want to be in. Sometimes you want to be able to go in and out on a character. This one, you didn't need that much. And every time I had impulsively made that decision, I ended up trying to figure out a way to cut it.
Nice. See, I love talking, because you know the cinematic language here.
I'm learning it all more. I mean, I had an intellectual understanding of this stuff, but then to be able to have an opportunity to really delve into it and become practical, and then hopefully at some point, if I get an opportunity to do it more and more, I'll get to forget about the practical and go back to an intuitive relationship with the medium.
Speaking of doing it more and more, do you have anything else cooking in that brain of yours?
Right now,
I know we're promoting Lucky now.
Yeah, we're promoting Lucky, but right now the process is, I read in Robert Altman interview once that he said, you know, producing movies is kind of like cooking. You got to keep things on the stove. You got to stir them a lot, and then one of them will boil, and that'll be the one you do.
Lots of back burners.
Exactly.
And
you got to keep
that sauce.
Yeah, and, you know, one of Harry Dean's phrases, which he said a lot in his life, and also when he wasn't sure he wanted to do something, he would go, well, let's just keep that on the burner. And
that's a great analogy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's a Robert Altman, too, and a Harry Dean Stanton. Now,
apparently, they. That's great. I imagine they had known each other over time.
Oh, that's great. Well, before we go, a lot of our listeners want to know the local angle here, you know, Catholic University.
Yeah, I
Memories
came to
of
Catholic,
your time there.
Yeah, I came to Catholic in 1981. I graduated in 86. I took a year off to go on National Players Tour, which was a tour that ran out of Catholic. I don't know if it even exists anymore. It was a repertory company that you travel all around the country and do Shakespeare for high schools and colleges. And I got my BFA in acting there. I started the process of learning how to act there. And more importantly for me, I also got a rounded liberal arts education. So I was able to, study poetry and study English and study music and study, computer science and
cooking
philosophy, history, religion. Exactly. But also things that come into play when you're actually thinking about the work.
Yeah.
Because the doing of it is so important, obviously, getting sure. good at it. But then there's the why am I doing it and right. what am I doing it for? Like, what do I want to actually say?
Right.
And this movie was, when I was offered this movie to direct, it was a no-brainer for me because I wanted to talk about the idea of how do I live well with my death in mind?
Yeah.
You know, I know it sounds kind of stark and everything, but it's not. It's a really great, again, I go to practical things. It's a very practical question.
Absolutely. Which is why I think our listeners are going to enjoy grappling with that very question, because it's a question we all face. So yeah. Thank you for handling it with such, delicacy and grace and beauty at times in the movie,
they're very funny people. It's a warm movie. It's a comedy, yeah. really, frankly. Yeah. I mean, if I were going to say what the genre is, it's a comedy.
Yeah, exactly. Awesome. Well, in closing, sort of bring it back to how we kind of started the interview. The fact that, you made this movie, it spoke to you so much, it spoke to Harry Dean so much, and now knowing that it's his last one, I mean, do you think that will give the film even more poignancy and even legs?
There's not a world that I'll know what it would have been like for us to open the movie and to have a premiere in Los Angeles where all of Harry's friends get to come and see him perform this role with him in the audience, and the kind of, I can only imagine the kind of raucous and sustained adoration that would have provided for him, because his work is so extraordinary in the film.
Yeah.
We'll never get to know what that would have felt like. I do know that I do know that I personally was very fortunate to have an opportunity to work with him and to tell a story that only he could tell.
Yeah. But he did get to see a cut, right?
Never got to see the full thing. He saw pieces of it. He saw the trailer. We kept on waiting for an opportunity for a big screen.
Right.
He's a big screen guy and we wanted him to see it. He wanted to see it on a big screen and not on an iPad.
Yeah.
And so.
But he got to live it, man. That was
to live it. And also, knowing Harry Dean, he wouldn't have cared anyway.
Yeah. That's the perfect place to leave it. John Carroll Lynch, thank you so much for joining us. It was
thank you.
An honor talking to you.
Thank you very much.